Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, you're listening to New Books in History, a channel with the New Books Network. I'm your host, Dexter Fergie. My guest today is Atoussa Araxia Abrahamian. She's a senior editor at The Nation magazine, and she probably has the most interesting beat in the world. Her work covers all of the cracks in the interstate system, from tax havens like Luxembourg to seemingly post-sovereign spaces like Svalbard. And today we'll be talking about her 2015 book, The Cosmopolites, The Coming of the Global Citizen. It's a deep dive into how globalization is transforming the meaning of citizenship and how the passport has become commodified, especially in recent years by both cosmopolitan elites collecting passports or governments trying to offload stateless populations. It's a fascinating and at times harrowing read. And I'm super excited that Atoussa is on the show. So thanks for being on the show.
Thanks for having me, Dexter.
And so just to begin, this book is very personal for you, like in an autobiographical way. And so I would love to hear about your passports and how you began to write the book.
Sure. So I am a very confused and mixed up person when it comes to citizenship and nationality. I was born in one country, Canada. I grew up in a second country, Switzerland. My parents were, my mother is a Swiss citizen, but she was born in Iran of Russian and Armenian provenance. My father, similarly, mixed up also by way of Iran and Armenia. And so it was just kind of a big mess of places and origins. But I never really got much of any of them because I was in such an international environment in Geneva and I was in an international school. All of that kind of got flattened, but in a nice way, into this big multicultural brew of people and places. And so I always thought it was quite weird when I met someone who deeply, deeply identified with their country of origin or the place that they lived. And this was in the back of my mind for some years, but I never really thought about it too much. I moved to the States for college and only really confronted where I was, quote unquote, from once I was trying to stay in the States after school ended because I had to get a visa. And, you know, I had always assumed, oh, I'm Canadian, like we're just like Americans, but a little further north. But actually, when it comes to visas, we're more like Mexicans, but further north, if you get what I'm saying. It was not easy. And that's when I really started thinking about, well, how absurd it is that we have to jump through all these hoops to just live somewhere where we want to live. And this isn't to say that I'm a particularly, you know, sad victim of the system. I'm not. This is really not what I'm trying to say. But as someone who is so privileged, still struggling, that's what really struck me. And so this was in the back of my mind when I started working as a journalist. And one day, and this is kind of how I, this is a long story, but this is how I ended up writing the book. One day I entered the green card lottery and I won the green card lottery, which is crazy. But then I lost it because I had written that I was a native of Switzerland. It just seemed like the most honest answer. You have to pick a country. Turns out I do not count as a native of Switzerland because I was not born there. Anyway, I got kicked out of the green card lottery. I was back to square one with the visa stuff. And during this period, I checked my spam folder in my email and I was invited to something called the Global Citizenship and Residence Conference. And I don't know if you check your spam mail ever. I just kind of click on it when I'm bored and sometimes someone wants to send me, you know, $10 million and whatever. Anyway, I clicked on this email and thinking it was going to be some kind of academic conference or a UN thing. And I go through the link and then I am sort of shocked to learn that there is a whole conference for people who want to buy passports. So I was thinking, oh, maybe this is going to answer all the questions I have about what it means to be from a place, what it means to be like a global citizen, you know, does it mean anything at all? And there I am, you know, looking at a picture of, I think it was the president of St. Kitts and Prime Minister of St. Kitts and Nevis, you know, preparing to give a speech about why their passport was so good to buy. And so that's kind of what set me off down this strange path of reporting on buying and selling passports. I went to the conference. I wrote about it. And that was when, you know, it's funny because it kind of confirmed my hunch, right, that citizenship wasn't this necessarily this super meaningful thing. And from my perspective, if you can buy it, then it really is not so special and sort of mystical and well, it can't be as special as people say it is if you can buy it, I guess, was my sort of first impression.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, that's so interesting. And yeah, I should probably check my spam folder. Who knows what projects are, you know, just waiting to be done. but just to sort of start us off, I was hoping that you could share a little bit about the historical meaning of citizenship. And the reason why I'd love to hear you talk about that, even if briefly, is because you're really looking at this like change over time that's happening in the latter decades of the 20th century, early decades of the 21st century. And so can you just tell us what citizenship meant, what national citizenship meant before your story?
So the passport is a relatively new technology, much like the modern nation state, right? We haven't lived in this particular configuration of the world for a very long time. My understanding of the history, and as a non-historian, that's my caveat, is that passports were not in wide use or circulation until basically the 20th century, which is around the time that borders started to harden and be policed, and countries would also guard their borders more jealously. And so citizenship, I suppose, became a requirement for travel. I mean, proof of citizenship became a requirement for travel. And as time went on, their visas came into play. Citizens from certain parts of the world were not allowed into other parts of the world, whether it was because of diplomatic issues, you know, the Iron Curtain, or for economic reasons. And so just purely in a functional sense, humans went from not really having to carry documents around with them all the time and prove where they were from, to always having to have to show proof of identity at national borders, which were being more and more policed. So that's why having a citizenship, proving your citizenship, and maybe most importantly, having the right one, became quite important by the time the 20th century rolled around.
Yeah, and so I think that sets us up really nicely, because even the prehistory to your story was a temporary state of affairs. Okay, so just to kind of turn towards the story in your book, a lot of it is about this like particular scheme between Comoros, which is a set of islands in the Indian Ocean, if I'm not mistaken, and two Gulf states, Kuwait and United Arab Emirates. And it's this scheme to basically offload to grant citizenship to the stateless populations in these Gulf states, but not citizenship in those countries, but citizenship in this like other country that has no historical connection to these states. And it's a really, it was a surprising story to me because I had never heard of it. But in the context of like the commodification of the passport, it's a really interesting angle. Because I'm thinking more about these wealthy elites jet setting and, you know, picking up passports and so on. And so can you talk about this story? Maybe just introduce it, maybe a character or two.
Yeah, sure. So the background to this scheme, which the short version is that the Comoro Islands sold a whole bunch of passports to the United Arab Emirates so that the UAE could document their stateless people. The sort of background and context to all of this goes back to what we were talking about before. Passports were foisted onto people. Borders were put up around people. And these categories didn't necessarily reflect the way people lived, who they were, where they really came from, how they identified. You know, these were constructs and technologies that popped up, and they didn't always make sense. And I think the UAE, the situation in UAE is a great example of that. The modern Emirati state, again, is a very recent, I want to say invention, but or should I say construction? It hasn't existed in its current format for a very long time. And when it was established in the 50s, there were some population surveys to see, you know, who lived there and who belonged and who would be part of this new country. And partly on purpose, and probably also partly not on purpose, a bunch of people were left out of these surveys. And that came back to bite them later because they were not considered citizens because they couldn't prove that they were in the territory or in a certain place at a certain time. That's the very, very glossed over, but basically accurate version of why there are people in the UAE who do not have, who are undocumented and who are stateless because the state will not recognize them as citizens and they have nowhere else to go. In around 2005, 2006, the Emiratis decided, for some reason, maybe there was pressure from the international community, that they wanted to solve this problem of statelessness. Now, the Emiratis have not, to my knowledge, even released an accurate count of how many people are stateless in their country, but they do acknowledge that there are stateless people called Bedouin, and they, you know, they wanted to document them for all of the reasons that a state would want to document people, right? This is a very useful thing to do, especially if you're sort of on the repressive / authoritarian side. It's good to account for populations. But of course, giving somebody Emirati citizenship is quite expensive. If you are Emirati, you have it made. It's a very generous state. So to sort of have their cake and eat it too, the Emiratis thought, okay, what's a third solution? And the third solution kind of came out of this existing market for passports. It's almost like you put two and two together. You think, okay, let's say you're a sheikh in the Emirates or the person in charge of this. Well, there's a market for passports. People can buy them. And we have some stateless people and we have lots of money. So instead of giving them, you know, a modicum of rights and representation here, let's just buy them a passport, which I guess is pretty seductive logic if you're a certain type of thinker. And fortunately, into this picture waltzed a businessman named Bashar Kiwan, himself a very global citizen, a French-Syrian media executive who had spent some time in the Comoro Islands and had been trying for a few years to come up with a scheme to develop those islands. And one thing led to the other, and he convinced the government of the Comoro Islands through some above-board methods and some less above-board methods that they ought to sell the UAE lots and lots and lots of passports and document, and I quote, their Muslim brothers and sisters in the UAE. If this sounds really weird and cynical, that's because there's definitely a really weird and cynical element to it. But at the same time, it does solve a problem, which is that all of these people in the Emirates, and look, on my count, and on my count based on some leaked documents I received, it's not a small number of people. It's like 30, 40, 50,000 people don't really have the means to officially identify themselves, you know, in as citizens of anywhere. And so if you go from having nothing to identify yourself with to having an actual passport, there's something to that. I'm not saying it's democratic or just or wonderful, but there's something to it. And so this scheme took off. This businessman, Bashar Kiwan, was kind of running the operation, even transferring some of the money from the UAE to the Comoros. Officially, you're talking about $200 million. So it's a lot of money for a small country. And in this manner, quite a lot of people who were previously stateless were documented. So one person for whom this didn't end particularly well, at least not initially, is a man named Ahmed Abdelkhalik. So he was one of the people who was sort of summoned to obtain a Comoros citizenship. I say summoned because people were kind of coerced into getting these passports. It wasn't a life or death thing, but it was definitely, there was definitely made clear to them, you know, in the newspaper by officials calling up people's houses that it would really behoove them to become Comoros citizens. And for Abdelkhalik, it was a matter of, oh, if you want to get your driver's license renewed or when you get the plates on your car, you should really come and get this passport. He wasn't crazy about the idea. He hadn't really heard of the Comoros besides in a history book once or twice, but he went ahead and he got the passport. Abdelkhalik was also an activist. He was part of a group that was advocating for more democracy and some human rights issues in the Emirates. And that doesn't always fly so well in the Emirates. So he was put in prison. He was arrested. And when he was in prison, he really had to confront the reality of being a Comoros citizen because his jailers gave him a choice. They said, well, Ahmed Abdelkhalik, you're a foreigner on Emirati soil, and so we're going to deport you. And they gave him a choice of a few countries, including, I think, Afghanistan, Iraq, I think Somalia or Sudan, and Thailand. And it turns out these are places that are fairly easy to get a visa with a Comoros passport. And so he's sitting in jail and he's like, okay, I guess I'll go to Thailand. His father rushes to get his passport, rushes to get him a visa. They put him on a plane and off he goes to Bangkok, which, you know, he'd never left the country before. If anyone was really identified as being Emirati and being local, it was this man. But he was unfortunately stateless through no fault of his own. So he winds up on the other side of the planet. The story is actually does have a sort of a happy ending because he gets helped out by some UN resettlement workers there, and he gets resettled in Canada, in London, Ontario. Big change from the Emirates. And so he's safe, you know, he's okay. But this is just to illustrate how disconnected passports can be from somebody's identity and how people can sort of be globalized against their will or through no initiative of their own. And, you know, when I was reporting on all of the rich people buying passports to avoid tax or to, you know, move their assets or to just be in a nicer climate, like Malta or Cyprus or St. Kitts and Nevis, I always thought, okay, I'm sure there's some shady stuff that goes on. This isn't the most savory business. But what are the stakes really? Because rich people are always going to do stuff like this. And when I realized that people were being, you know, essentially forced to take a foreign citizenship and potentially being deported as a result of it, deported from their home, that really raised the stakes for me with the story. And so I thought that was a really important part of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think Khalik's story is really important for your story. I hadn't actually considered how, for an autocrat that's not willing to extend humanity to its stateless population, the autocrat actually doesn't have that many options, because if they're stateless, then they can't just be sent off to another country because they don't have any proof of citizenship anywhere. So this scheme to assign this like specially carved up citizenship for, in a foreign country to its stateless population actually gave these governments more leverage over those populations.
That's right. And especially if you consider the fact that the terms of these, what they call economic citizenships of the Comoros Islands, were such that they didn't actually seem to grant people who had the passport the right to live in the Comoros Islands, which is really odd. And then it makes you think, well, is it even citizenship? Is it just a passport? Is it something else? Is it another category of belonging? And I think I think there's something to be said for that as well. Like, what does it even mean to be a citizen if this is what mm-hmm. it means, you know?
Mm-hmm. And maybe just to conclude this part of the story, like, what happens to this scheme and what does this look like? How does it play out in Comoros itself?
Yeah, it's definitely worth looking into why on earth the Comoros Islands would get themselves into such a bizarre international intrigue. And the reason is money. It's a really poor country. This seemed like a quick way to raise some cash. And if you ask me, they were kind of manipulated into it. You know, it's this middleman, Bashar Kiwan, sold the program really, really hard. There were definitely some incentives and perks for members of parliament to sign on to it. Many of the parliamentarians were against it until they were taken on an all expenses paid trip to Dubai, at which point they returned home and suddenly felt a little more amenable to the scheme. So there was all kinds of things going on behind the scenes that may have contributed to the country passing this legislation. But there were all kinds of things going on behind the scenes that may have contributed to the parliament passing this legislation. But at the same time, this scheme, these $200 million coming from the UAE, these were going to be a lifeline for the islands. They were going to build roads. They were going to, fix some of the plumbing. They were going to, create all kinds of public services. They were going to, help, in theory, boost the tourism sector, rehabilitate some old hotels, bring in more business. And so it was pitched as an economic development initiative, which unfortunately didn't really pan out. Anyone who's done business in the Comoros will say, oh, it's very corrupt. It's really hard to do business. There's some truth to that. But there was also a lot of grift and a lot of money sort of magically disappearing into offshore accounts. So it didn't quite work out the way it was supposed to. And I think that many of the people who were for this program in the Comoros were disappointed and now, would vote very differently if they could go back in time.
Hmm. Yeah, and so I'd like to pivot towards that other market for passports, the market that consists of these wealthy buyers, and I would just to kind of to start off, I would like to know why someone would want more passports. I mean, it might sound obvious, but I'd like to kind of know more about the motivations for collecting passports.
Mm-hmm. The motivations for collecting passports tend to be one of three or four elements. One is that you're a rich person from a place with a bad passport. And that's not something you can just shake off by having a lot of money. Like it sucks. If you're a rich person from, let's say, China, and you need to get visas whenever you want to go to the US or whenever you want to go to Europe or whenever you want to go on vacation someplace. You don't want to stand in line at the embassy if you're like Mr. Moneybags, right? That's something that poor people do or just normal people do. And that sort of mix of entitlement and ego and convenience is really powerful. And I think that having that extra passport where you can just hop on a plane and get the hell out of here, that's a very, very strong motivation.
Yeah, I mean, respond quickly, like reading your book, it was interesting to see how like someone's class position can actually be inhibited by their national identity. Like there are these obstacles that are, keeping these elites from actually manifesting their true class position as they see it.
That's so true. Yeah. That's a good way to put it. Of course you can pay someone to wait in line at the embassy for you or hire a service, but it's still just that thing, that you have to think about that you don't want to think about. And if you can throw money at the problem, why wouldn't you? So I find that understandable. And I'm even a little, I think people should be able to go wherever the hell they want, whenever they want. And so I'm sympathetic, right? maybe not to the ultra high net worth aspect, but certainly to the part of it that seeks, you know, mobility and this, you know, freedom, I guess, to travel. Having another citizenship, depending on what your original citizenship is, can help you avoid some taxes. If you're American, actually, something that some wealthy Americans have done is get another passport and renounce the U.S. one, because the U.S. taxes its citizens regardless of where they live. And whether or not they're actually paying more depends on their situation, but you've got to file a tax return. You're on the hook. You know, you have to deal with the IRS, even if you've been living in Malta for 45 years. So that's another reason, right? Tax. And I'm not a tax attorney, but there are lots of ways that you can, you know, use another passport to your advantage for tax purposes. Actually, now that we're seeing some of these global minimum tax proposals getting kicked around, I'm very curious to see if there's going to be a country that opts out of these agreements and whether that will become a passport of convenience for banking for a certain type of person. And then, you know, there's also a deep sort of paranoia or persecution complex that can take hold if you're a certain kind of rich person. And this is anecdotal. I'm just saying what I've observed. But if you're, you know, if you tend to have right-wing ideas and you're worried about things like inflation and the government getting involved in your business, and, you know, you want to be able to, leave your home very quickly if you need to, right? Because you're scared the government's going to come after you. You also want to be able to move your money really quickly. So that's kind of a combination of the two factors I just discussed. And then I guess there's a fourth one, which is sometimes people just really want to live somewhere else. And this isn't always they don't always take the economic citizenship route, buying a St. Kitts passport. But, you know, I have friends who have tried to get citizenships through their great grandparents because they don't want to live in the U.S. anymore. They want to live in Europe. And that's kind of the easiest way to do it. And it does end up costing them money. But that's not strictly citizenship by investment. So, yeah, I think there are good reasons and less honest reasons to acquire more passports. And I think it would be good if everyone had an equal shot at having more than one, rather than this being really reserved for the ultra rich.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and maybe this is a good moment to bring in Christian Kalin, the chairman of Henley & Partners, and basically just like this industry that kind of swoops in to provide, you know, consulting for these ultra rich passport purchasers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Earlier on, I mentioned that I went to this conference, this sort of junket for people who want to buy passports and the people that are trying to sell them. It turns out, I learned very quickly that there was a whole industry around buying and selling passports. This is maybe predictable, you know, capitalism, I guess. But there are these firms that will do two things at once. They will advise countries, usually poor, small, sparsely or minimally populated countries, many of which happen to be former colonies. Make of that what you will. So these consultants will advise the governments of these countries on what they can do, how they can monetize their citizenship, or sometimes residence as well. So a permanent resident card, for example. And much like this Comoros scheme, it does get pitched or kind of framed as a means to economically develop the country, to raise real estate prices for, you know, beach condos, to boost the tourism sector and other sort of classic economic development initiatives. And these consultants will talk to the countries, but then they will also cultivate private clients to buy who will be the potential buyers of the citizenship. And Christian Kalin he's been described as the passport king, and I think that's a pretty accurate title if we're gonna give people titles. Kalin is a Swiss by birth, has the last I checked has just shy of a dozen passports. I think it was around 10, and has really made a lucrative and prominent career of being a sort of a passport broker. And he got his start in the Caribbean. I think he started off in Dominica and St. Kitts, realized that, you know, there were these little loopholes in their laws that allowed for the sale of citizenship, and turned these into really, really multi-million dollar enterprises. On the backs of passport sales, St. Kitts was able to sell lots of condos, because they developed, with Kaylin's help, a program wherein you buy an apartment and they throw in a passport for free. There are schemes where if you donate to a certain fund, you can get a passport at a reduced price. After some pretty bad hurricanes hit the region, countries lowered their prices because they were trying to raise money for, you know, reconstruction efforts. So it has really become like a tool of these countries to raise money at various points. And of course, there are consultants on the sidelines skimming off of the edges as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I mean, but Kaylin also just seems like such an interesting figure. I mean, he did a dissertation on tax havens, I think. What was he like on a personal level?
Yeah, Kaylin, I think, fancies himself a bit of an intellectual, and he is. He certainly thinks deeply about the line of work he's in. And you know, when you get into these circles, there's always a little bit of like revisionist history where they'll find like an example of someone in ancient Rome who bought a passport and say, oh, look, like this has always existed, as a way of sort of legitimizing the whole thing. I, you know, I'm not a historian of ancient Rome. I don't know if these things happened or not, but there's definitely an effort to sort of, I don't want to say whitewash, because while there is a lot of shady activity that happens in the sale of passports, I don't think it is necessarily shady. But to, I guess, sugarcoat, legitimize, professionalize this world, take it from the domain of Bond villains to something that a respectable, you know, CEO would be involved in.
Yeah, and so another sort of element to all of this is, and this comes out in one of the conferences that you attended. It might have been the Global Citizenship Conference, but there's also there's a lot of ideology going on about, you know, how, you know, like being a global citizen, you know, i.e. like having passports in a number of former colonies, perhaps other places. It's cosmopolitan. It's like doing good. There's a rendition of We Are the World at one of these things. And I find that really interesting, because there is this very utopian or optimistic project potentially in all of this, and kind of like breaking apart the passport as this exclusive feature of the interstate system, but it's limited to this very select group of people.
Yeah, the term global citizenship comes up a lot in this world, and my first instinct was that it's a very cynical use of the term. If we are to think of the term as something basically, you know, a little crunchy and nice and cosmopolitan. And the term global citizenship has definitely been kind of co-opted and turned into a marketing pitch to make rich people feel special and good about buying their passports, rather than, I guess, feeling cynical about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think the way that you kind of bring in this optimism is through earlier manifestations of global citizenship. So you talk about Gary Davis. Is it mm-hmm. Gary or Jerry?
Gary.
Gary. Okay. So Gary Davis. This guy is so interesting, and I was so excited to see that you actually got a chance to interview him. Do you want to share with our listeners who he was and what he wanted?
Gary Davis was an American man, came from an upper middle class family. His father was a band leader, and he fought in World War II. And this really, really marked him. He lost his brother, and he wrote a number of books about his experience in the war and after the war. And there's a very vivid section in one of his books where he's flying a plane. I guess he's going to throw bombs down onto Germany. And he has just this feeling of like, what am I doing here? Why am I doing this? We're all the same. You know, it sounds really schmaltzy, but I think it was quite heartfelt, as evidenced by what he did after the war, which was to take off his uniform, fly to Paris, walk to the U.S. embassy, and renounce his citizenship, because the effect of fighting in the war was so profound on him, and it made him despise nationalism so deeply that he decided that he wanted nothing to do with it, and that he couldn't associate himself with a nation state any longer, and also live, you know, in a way that lived up to his personal ethics and morals. So Gary Davis called himself World Citizen Number One. Note, world citizen, not global citizen. There's maybe some subtlety there that some of the listeners can identify. And he lived the rest of his life as somebody who is stateless by choice. And Gary Davis, I mean, he was a legend. He printed his own passport, walked around with it, and played these tricks to get governments to stamp it. So he would wait until he was in France when he renounced his papers, and he was only there for on a limited stay visa. His visa was about to run out. And so he would just say, okay, I'm going to go into an embassy, and I'm no longer on French territory. You can't catch me here. He would also try to get arrested on purpose to, you know, draw attention to himself. And he basically did what I would call performance art around the absurdity of borders and nationality. And he kind of fell off the public map a few years into this, but he ended up living until quite an old age in Vermont. And I met him in New York a few years before he died. And it's funny because I thought I'd lost the recording, and then I got a new phone and it downloaded my old iCloud files, and I found it, and I was so excited that I was able to use the interview. He was definitely an idealist, but he was also very self-aware, and I think he knew exactly what he was doing.
Yeah, I actually really like your reading of him, because it is so easy to kind of see say that he didn't accomplish what he wanted. But then when you actually look at what he was doing, he was finding all these weird rules of the interstate system and bending them towards his purpose. He's finding those cracks, you know, trying to get arrested so that he was put in jail rather than deported, for instance. I think that's totally right, that this should be read as performance art of border regimes or something.
And he actually, so another thing Gary Davis would do is he would send people, world passports and give them to people. He gave me one. I think one of the last things he did was send Edward Snowden a world passport, because Ed Snowden was having some problems finding a place to live. Also camping out at, you know, the Moscow airport, which is a very Gary Davis thing to do. And did he achieve anything? Well, he was a celebrity in his time. He crashed the UN General Assembly. He was friends with Camus. He did all kinds of stuff that we don't know about him now, because I think that his vision of the world is a little outmoded. But at the time, and I wasn't there, but based on what I've read, at the time, there was a lot of enthusiasm behind these ideas, because let's not forget, World War II was so traumatic, and it really made people think hard about, you know, what are borders, what is citizenship, why are we doing this? And I think it's useful to revisit that, because, you know, arguably we're in a moment like that now also with climate change and COVID, and all of these kind of conventions are proving themselves maybe not so integral in the face of nature. And So I think a lot about that period and the people who inhabited that world and the kinds of activism they were doing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I mean, this goes beyond the scope of your book, but like that post-war moment, this sort of moment before the Cold War became the consensus and world system, there was like a lot of grassroots organizing towards one worldism. And it had everything to do with this just catastrophic, you know, human tragedy that was the Second World War. You know, like thinking that this was a result of, you know, like everyone being contained by nation states that are constantly in competition with one another. That sort of moment passed, unfortunately.
That definitely what ended up happening is that even some outspoken sort of world federalists resorted to the nation because they figured it was a more realistic way to give people rights. And, you know, this federal world federalism kind of did not prevail.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, also even just like a lot of, erstwhile internationalists became Cold Warriors because they saw the Soviet Union as this new existential threat. I want to turn the page a little bit. So I'm a historian or a historian in training, and I am in awe of the kind of research that you do because it really is so different from the research that I'm accustomed to doing. And so I was just wondering if you could share a little bit about, how you... this is a really big and potentially unwieldy question, but like how you approach your research, like to me, you're talking about these really big picture structures, but at the level of, narrative and biography.
Yeah, I'm happy to share, but tell you about it, but I wouldn't recommend it to anyone. So I'm a journalist by training, and what we are supposed to do is find the stories and the people first. And unfortunately, that's just not how my brain works. And I go backwards, and I have, you know, like I had a hunch that citizenship was kind of this messed up thing that maybe is not great or maybe is not an accurate reflection of the way people actually live. And then I just kind of stewed in like misery and anger for a few years. And then I read that email and it kind of started coming together. So that's the process, just deep frustration and angst. And then maybe I'll read an article and the world starts to make sense a little bit more. In terms of the narrative and the, I guess, quote unquote content, I mostly rely on interviews with people. And also if I'm reporting in a place that I don't know well, I'll just try to find a couple of good local papers and read everything there is on the subject that I'm researching. I speak French, so the Comoros, that was possible for me. But I don't speak Arabic, and so the UAE part of that story was tough. I ended up hiring a research assistant to help me out a little bit with that stuff. So that's mostly, and I use an app called Evernote. I don't know if you know it, but whenever I read an article or, you know, something online that seems, or an academic paper, that seems relevant or something that I might need down the line, I'll just save it into Evernote. And then I can really quickly like look for keywords and find it again. And kind of, I make a lot of timelines if I'm working on narrative. So that's the process. It's not very efficient. And like I said, I wouldn't recommend it to anybody. I'm working on another book now and it's kicking my ass.
Oh yeah, I definitely want to hear a little bit about that book, but so I think what makes your kind of work really challenging is the geographic scope, and it's like not just like usually when we think about international geographies, you know, people are thinking like Europe, North America, maybe like you know China, like it's always these bigger countries, bigger powers in the international system. But your research tends to pull you towards these, these like far-flung locales that, I mean, I knew nothing about Comoros before reading this book.
I knew nothing about Comoros before writing this book. I had never even heard of it.
That's amazing. So that was one of the sources of my question. I was just curious about like how you actually approach these things that could be very unwieldy.
Yeah, it's unwieldy. I mean, I think the way to do it is to find people who carry you through it and characters with interesting stories. And I was fortunate enough that there were plenty of them for this, for the Cosmopolites. So thank you to the people who exist in the world. but to your point about smaller countries that are maybe a little off the beaten path, I think that there's tremendous value in places that seem like the exception and really can tell you a bit more about the way the world works as a rule. You know, there are so many places that we don't think about because they're far away or they're small or they don't seem important. They don't seem powerful, but they're part of the system too. And I think you said earlier that we live in a world where states are constantly in competition with each other. Well, that actually forces a lot of small countries to get really creative and come up with things to compete with, which is how, you know, you get passport selling, and lots of other little quirky industries. And I'm really fascinated by those.
Yeah. I actually think that that's almost akin to what Gary Davis was doing, like finding these little rules and bending them. I've encountered your work on like Luxembourg and you know, its desire to be the space law nation, but it's a small country that is again just like trying to find little niches for itself. I think this might be a good segue into your next book, which I think deals with this a bit more head on. Do you want to give listeners a tidbit about it?
Yeah, I've been knee deep in it and I'm banging my head against the wall. So it might not be as clear as it will be someday. But the next book is about, it's called, tentatively called The Hidden Globe. And it's about, it's basically about extraterritoriality. It's about places where the rules don't completely apply in some shape or form. So that includes free ports, that includes, you know, embassies in the UN and other kind of diplomatic buildings. The oceans, outer space, special economic zones, all of these places that are so integral to the way the world works in terms of trade, in terms of diplomacy, in terms of regulation, but that aren't really anywhere, or they're sort of semi-places. And I'm still working on this, but I'm trying to understand how they contribute to the world and how they fit together. And I think it's going to be, once I write it, it will be good.
I have the same inkling. It's a really exciting project. These are places that get overlooked in a lot of the academic literature, but then also just in the popular imaginary as well.
Yeah, we think of the world as really being sort of neatly cut up into nation states, but there's all this weird stuff in between. And that doesn't necessarily challenge, it maybe appears to challenge the nation state, but in reality, it doesn't. It more or less enables nation states to keep doing what they're doing, for better or for worse.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, like a lot of these spaces are actually produced by the international system or interstate system.
Completely.
Well, Atusa, I want to thank you so much for speaking with me today.
It was my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. And we've been discussing Atusa Araxia Abrahamian's book, The Cosmopolites, The Coming of the Global Citizen. And you've been listening to New Books in History, a channel with the New Books Network.